Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am joined today by Daniel Gross from the Institute for European Policymaking. Also, two of Bruegel's most fabulous scholars, Reinhilde Wöglers and Mario Marinello. We are going to be talking about the brain drain out of the U.S., which is a fun change from worrying about all of the resources that might have been going to the U.S. in past years and in past contexts. As all of you know, there was an election in the U.S. There has been a very different environment for people working on any kind of visa in the U.S. right now. And Europe is thinking, what if some of them are scientists? And what if some of those scientists would like to do science and other interesting and cool things in Europe? Reinhilde, tell us about this data play. The European Commission is throwing some money at this. There have been individual countries that have been putting out initiatives from various universities to try and attract people. What's going on?
I would really like to start also a bit more with the background of, first of all, how important science and innovation are for productivity growth and beyond here. And that if we want the science and innovation machine really to be working, this is basically an international machine. So the international flow of ideas and people is really crucial for having science and innovation really as a growth driver here. So this is everything that would block that international operations is something that will have a long-term effect on the objectives that we want to realize here. That holds in general for the world, but that also holds particularly also for Europe here. We could therefore see a bit this current shock that we have in the US as something, that's good news for Europe. We can attract some of these talents maybe. But overall, I would still like to warn also for a bit of a negative effect in the sense that this will in general might actually hold back the creation of really new ideas. The US is an important source of new ideas here. And if that gets limited, we will also feel the negative effect on that here. So it's not just something that we can say, we can benefit from this here. There is also a long-term cost here. And overall, we should really try to make sure that that science and innovation machine keeps as open as possible here. Having said that, of course, there is the option of bringing back talents here. The question is, to which extent is the EU an attractive location for this? And is it enough to really offer a bit of money on that? If we take a look at the longer-term research we've been doing on that, on what drives mobility decisions and how do people researchers decide on where they would move here. Of course, what's very important for them is how good they will be in terms of science and how good the host environment will be. So the quality of the host environment is very important here. And of course, part of the quality of the environment is how much access does it give you to research, and that includes also access to research funding here. But it's not the only part of the story here. So the quality of the research environment in terms of the quality of your peers that you're able to work with is very important, the kind of the quality of the students that you're attracting. So high quality institutions and research environments is very important here. And that's a long-term effect here. So that will not be changed by one-off decisions on research funding here. That's not to say that research funding is not important, but it should really be in the light of strong long-term credentials that we're offering here. So the question now is a bit of whatever we are reacting now, does that fit within that longer term willingness to really go for these high tech and high quality environments here? So the question is a bit how credible this is also in the longer term.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The talk of long-term considerations really makes a lot of sense. This May 2025 is the 14th anniversary of my move to Europe from the United States. And I can attest that there are many, many factors that go into why one comes here and the environment in which one stays. Daniel, you have also moved around. You are now back in academia after a long time in the Brussels think tank world and before that doing other things. And you and Bruegel's own Heather Graby have an idea about how to make the most of this moment. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, and I think I can build on what Reinhilde just said. We need to work on improving the overall research environment in Europe and do so on a sustainable basis. And that was the starting point for the work with Heather. And we thought that what we need at this point is a European initiative why European? Because it remains at the national level, then there's always a danger that it is meant to favor national institutions or national scientists. And if you do it at the European level, the chances are much higher that you have really good competition for the best positions, for the best ideas and the best projects. And also, of course, we need to have something that is, as Anhilde said, longer term sustainable. And when we look at what has been proposed so far, like the 500 million over 3 years proposed by Ursula von der Leyen, we think that's a good gesture. But this amount of money then limited to 3 years is not going to work because we need the longer term perspective. And the second point is that there are specific areas where it is worth to make a special effort, because the current Trump U.S. administration is a particularly enemy, is a particularly hostile to research on climate change, which is one of the key points for us in Europe here with the Green Deal and now the Clean Deal and in general our aim to become leaders in green technology. And since we have lots of financing for, let's say, green endeavors, green technology in Europe, we thought that some of the existing financing could be redirected towards attracting high-quality talent from the US, but perhaps also from elsewhere in the world. And one particular source would be something that most people probably don't know. It's called the Innovation Fund. That's a special fund which gets money from the tax on emissions in Europe, which has an overall budget of almost 4 billion euros per year. And our idea was if we just redirect even only 10% of that amount to attracting researchers with long-term projects, maybe also helping them to safeguard important databases and ongoing scientific projects, then we would have a continuous flow of funding, let's say around 400 million per year for a very long time. And I think that should be attractive, since after all, climate change is something which is not happening. It's happening every day, but it's a very long-term issue. And in the same vein, we have also unspent funding also for green and digital transition under the Next Generation EU big project, where a large amount has not been committed. And we thought, again, these uncommitted funds could be used to attract researchers both in the area of climate change and also in the what we call the digital transition, mainly software and ancillary developments. Here again, the amounts are pretty large. 40 billion remain uncommitted. Again, 10% of that, even 5%, would be 2 to 4 billion euros. Now, this would be a lump sum, again, distributed over 10 years. One could have a very nice series of longer-term projects and positions and funding for high-level researchers or research groups, even better, to attract them from the U.S. to establish themselves long-term in Europe. As Renilde said earlier, maybe we should not be looking so much at individual researchers from the U.S., but at getting entire research groups which have lost funding in the U.S., and who can continue their work in Europe, benefiting, by the way, not only Europe, but the entire world. So these are some of the ideas that Heather and I have put together.
Mario, do researchers like to move around, or are they inclined to stay where they do their studies or where they're from? What are you finding on that?
It's a good question. First of all, thank you for inviting me to the podcast. It's a already very interesting discussion. I share very much the views of Renilde and Daniel that they just expressed. We definitely need to have a long-term perspective. We need to have investment in infrastructure, essentially. We don't only need to attract researchers, we need to keep them. We need to build an ecosystem. We all share somehow these considerations. But let's say with Nina Ruhr, we have decided to play a little bit with data and try to, you know, to do some kind of thought experiment in order to find out some tendency that we could observe in the data that individual researchers might display that make them like more inclined to relocate. Of course, I agree with Daniel. I mean, like maybe, you know, focusing too much on the individuals is not the right thing to do. But, you know, we thought with Nina, maybe we can just, you know, start from there and have a look. In fact, I mean, like, you know, what actually triggered our interest was this poll from Nature. The journal actually, they made a poll among the readers in the US, and they found out that 75% of them are actually considering leaving the country after what, you know, what we are seeing happening because of the choices of the US administration. Now, of course, these are just, you know, stated preferences. They are just somehow thoughts, even with a strong emotional basis. But we thought maybe, you know, let's try to find some ideas in the data that could give us like a flavor of what really, I mean, like researchers might be doing in the future. Okay. So what we have thought to do was like to look at the educational partners that researchers in the US had. We looked at those who are currently working in the US. They have an affiliation with the university in the US, but they have studied abroad in the past. So they have a PhD or they have a master or an undergraduate degree in other countries, and in particular in Europe. So what we have found is that almost 10% of top researchers, you know, it's definition, which is also somehow a bit subjective, but it depends on the number of quotes that they receive. It's just one way, let's say, to single out a group of researchers. But we found that about 10% of those of top researchers that are in the US actually have a degree which they pursued in Europe. And also we found that early career researchers, so those who are currently doing a postdoc in the US in top universities that have been targeted by the US administration, also a considerable chunk of them have pursued you know, a degree in Europe, like between 7% and 19% of the those groups that we have identified in these top universities. Now, does that mean that these people will be tomorrow relocate to Europe? Definitely not, of course, because as also Renide pointed out, there are many factors that influence the choice of them. However, it tell us something. No? These researchers have, you know, probably still ties in Europe. They, you know, they might have like a good experience. They might think, you know, with nostalgia to those time that they spent in Europe. Now that, I mean, like, they're facing all this oppressed in the research environment in the US. So we think that this could be an indication that there is a significant part of researchers that could be ready to relocate in the future if things remains as they are.
Reinhilde, you wanted to come in, and I know you've looked at these kinds of data in the past. What are you thinking about now?
Yeah, I really like to also emphasize that a lot of the mobility, and particularly the mobility between the EU and the US, happens in the early stages of the research careers here. So we have a lot of flows from students that do their PhD or their postdoc in the US, and the US because it's the frontier, and that's where they can actually build up their know-how even better. And then, of course, there is then the possibility also to return back to Europe. Not, and from our own research, we know that's not necessarily the best ones that are also returning, because if the best ones, they can stay in top places in the US, and that's what they will prefer here. But even if it's not the best ones that are returning, the ones that are still returning are still better than the ones that are local here. So it still makes sense also to attract return migration here of these postdocs and PhDs as well here. But that also identifies that what's really important is not just how much research funding you would give them, but for them, it's very important that they have positions that they can actually acquire in Europe and at top places here. This is why I want to be a bit more careful than what Daniel was saying. So we need initiatives at the EU level for to understand the argument here. But in the end, if you give a grant, but there is no institution that is really offering them a position, they will not be returning here. So that's why you still need also institutions, universities, to be able to offer those positions, tenure track positions or permanent positions here. And they need to, if there is less funding for universities, and in some countries this is really what we're seeing happening, these positions will not be there. And then it doesn't help that the EU is offering extra grants on that. But what I do think that Europe definitely can do is, because the more these universities know that their candidates have these grants and prestigious grants like the ERC, the more they will be willing to also offer them positions here. But what's very important for the ERC, for the EU grants, and particularly for the ERC, is that the grants are mobile grants here. So they don't go to institutions, they go to individuals, and individuals can then select with their feet which are the best institutions where they can go to. And then you get also much more competition among the better institutes to attract this kind of funding here. So that's really the strength of EU funding here, is using the EU mobility aspects of these grants here. That doesn't hold for the Marie Curie, for instance, where they go to the institutions, but the ERC is a portable one, and it's that portable that really makes it very, very much more powerful here. But in the end, it all depends on the host institutions being willing to offer positions and longer term positions for a lot of these return young people here. And another comment I have, if I may, Rebecca, on the climate change, I fully agree with that. That's definitely an area where Europe cares more about this than others. But here I would, and I also fully agree that we would have to spend a bit more on attracting researchers in that area here, but not only attracting them. So if we could also have more funding that would go to international collaboration, so that our European partners would work together with the US expertise that is being built up in climate change here, that would, I think, maybe be more effective here. It doesn't require necessarily that people have to move. They can at least collaborate internationally here, and then we can still hopefully maintain the momentum in getting more insights from the next generation science and technology and climate by collaborating here. And that is, I have to say, sometimes a bit of a problem, because also, like for instance, at ERC, we have these synergy grants, but it's really restricted on how much of those synergy grants can actually be also located outside Europe here. So very often the constraint is that whatever we spend has to be spent in Europe, but then you cannot really, you're missing a bit out on the potential for collaboration with the US here. And I think for eventually the outcome we want in terms of making sure the science and innovation machine keeps on running, we need to also look at this international collaboration where Europe will also be benefiting from as a mechanism to sustain.
Super interesting. Couple of things I want to tease out. First of all, you talked about how a lot of this happens in the early career. So those are people who presumably aren't as expensive as fancy, experienced, dug-in researchers, but also people who are very mobile. I don't think we're suggesting that one has to study in the U.S. to be a top European researcher, but it is an option for people who want to explore that mobility at this stage in their career. And it's something really interesting. And I'm thinking now about the implications of funding European researchers to study all over the world with the expectation that they, or at least the hope that they might bring that back home. So a lot of interesting things going around. The next part of our podcast, we will dig a little bit more into these themes. Mario, what did you have to say?
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to throw a question to the floor to Renilde and Daniel. What do they think about the interplay with the actually local researchers? Because of course these programs are supposed to attract people. But, I mean, now we talk a lot about researchers in the US for obvious reasons. But I mean, you could even think about, generalizing that and focus on researchers that come from abroad, let's say. But do you think that this could create some tension with you know, the let's say the domestic research community, if you know, researchers wouldn't have access to the same level of funding, also considering that there is also a need, of course, to to increase funding for in general, not just for relocation. So what are your thoughts about that?
No, you're quite right that there are many different problems in bringing European research, I would say, up to the underlying potential that we have in Europe. And it's true that there's a particular issue with younger researchers going to the US and maybe remaining there. I would say that let us now focus on the particular situation created by Trump. We cannot solve all the problems in one go. And that's why I made the plea to say, let's do something specifically geared to this situation. And I would not make it dependent on there being people who return, so being European nationals. I would say not even they have to be U.S. nationals. What I was thinking of was an EU-wide call for projects, non-linked to institutions, as Renhilde rightly said, so that there's competition among European institutions, European research institutions and European universities, who can attract the best. And since this would be additional funding, to answer to Mario, I don't think this would necessarily be met by opposition from the domestic incumbents, because the call would be open to anybody, including Europeans. It's just that we hope that if we increase our funding, especially in these areas which are now being gutted in the US, the likelihood is that many from the US will apply. If people from Europe win these tenders, so much the good, but that means other position, Europe will be free, right? This is all interconnected. And therefore, our idea was to reply to Reinhilde that when we make it European, transportable across countries, then you have a competition also at the national level, maybe to say, okay, I'm willing to chip in a bit to create here the nucleus of top research institution. And this is the way I would recommend to proceed. There are many other problems that might need to be addressed, but I would really say, let's take this specific situation and have a specific instrument to deal with this one issue.
I want to talk a little bit more about working with local researchers and being in a local environment. We've seen in the headlines that universities in Belgium and in Germany have been those at the forefront of trying to attract some of the talent in this particular moment in time. Meanwhile, among us, we have an interesting combination of languages, right? We have Mario, who is from Italy and working in Brussels, mostly in English. We have Daniel, who is from Germany, passed through Brussels, now working in Italy at a university there. Reinhilde, you're at this university in Leuven that is now at least as well known for some of its English programs as it is for its traditionally strong Flemish programs. So what should we make of this shift toward either using English as a lingua franca or at least moving around? How does that fit into these mobility concerns?
Yeah, that's a really very critical question you're asking in Flanders here, because as you rightly say, the University of Leuven really tries to go for excellence, the best of talents, being internationally positioned here. We do offer both in terms of faculty as well as students here, so we do have English programs, but we constantly have to fight with the Flemish government that we can, first of all, organize also English masters here. We can only do this if there is an equivalent in Dutch. Can you imagine the cost of that? And also, if we want to recruit international faculty, so they can only get a permanent position if they speak sufficiently fluently Flemish, and the level that's required of that is really very high, and that makes us way more difficult to compete on international markets on top of the lower wages that we're offering relative to the US here. So I think politicians sometimes also don't really understand that how competitive internationally this market is and this war for talents here, and that some of these restrictions they put from being locally embedded in terms of language is really something that puts us apart here and makes us lose in this international competition that is rolling here.
It is very true that since English is a lingua franca of research, that increases very much mobility across frontiers within Europe, across the Atlantic, even across the Pacific. But as Reinhilde pointed out, very often it's the national governments that are not so sure they want to have too many foreigners doing excellent research. In Germany, for example, many positions are reserved, also full professorial positions, for people who speak enough German. And as you know, German is not so easy to learn. But there are counterexamples. For example, there's the Max Planck Gesellschaft in Germany, which is free of these restrictions, and where more than one half of all the heads of the institutions are foreigners, and they're proud of having achieved this. So I think this is also a call for, let's say, competition among national governments, who offers all the other elements, right? Languages, teaching load, research facilities, salary scales, and all these things to researchers. And of course, some countries are losing out because at the national level, don't see the value of research. And unfortunately, I must say, this is a lot the case in many countries in Eastern Europe. And even in the old EU member countries, there are those who see the value of research and make efforts, not just in terms of budget, but also in terms of creating the conditions for top talent to flourish. And I think that these efforts have to increase, and we have to increase the competition. And I thought with Heather that when we have these European calls for proposals, that would increase this competition.
Conditional on the fact that they are portable, so that actually you really play out the EU competition. And I think whether also to follow up a little bit on what you were saying, Danielle, I think we also need really to make perhaps a better case of why it's important to really have top talent attracted here and or attracted or present within here. So science is a very skewed phenomenon. And really the boundaries are pushed by few of excellence. These highly cited researchers, they really are contributing over proportionally to progress in science here. So having these top researchers is really important, not only for progressing science, but also if you look at the throughput of this to innovation. Innovation really also relies on the frontier advantages and knowledge and not of all the incremental research, which is also important, but the push in also in innovation comes from this highly influential research here. And so if you want those excellent innovations, you also need to be close enough connected to the frontiers of science as well here. So we do also see that those that are attracting the top science talents are also very often very well connected in these innovation ecosystems, which are also very much concentrated on talents and international mobile talents as well here. So that's all very connected ecosystems here.
That's a message to the next commission and those who negotiate the next multi-annual financial framework, that they shouldn't say, oh, we have to have excellent researchers everywhere, which of course is true, ideally we would like to have. But we have to accept that some places are better than others, and that competition is the only way to find out, not to make sure that every country gets the same number of ERC grants or something similar. That's the political message which von der Leyen should give, not just the 500 million.
I just wanted to complement what Reinhilde just said, to broaden it up, in fact. Because, here we are talking about researchers, but of course we have a general problem of skills in general in Europe. And clearly the things go together, right? I mean, you want to build like a good educational environment. And this, of course, one of the factors that is attracting like the top researchers, for example. But what I wanted to say is that this is very much on the radar of the European Commission in some ways, especially when it comes to innovation and technological policy. A few weeks ago, the Commission has presented this plan, which is called the AI Continental. And this rests on five pillars. And one of those pillars is, in fact, skills. And the idea is like to become more attractive to the external world. You know, this plan has been designed in a kind of a pre-Trump era, so it's not contingent to what is happening in the US. I think we see a strong need in Europe to beef up the skill dimension, and we are definitely not there yet. I just wanted to drop a figure that just for the listeners. We have a target for 2030. The European Commission set a target for at least 80% of the European Union population to have at least basic digital skills. At the moment, we are, I think, 58%, and there is no way that we are going to reach the target. So, clearly, there should be a big incentives to work on that.
In the last section of our podcast, I'd like to come back to the outputs of this research. Daniel, you mentioned climate as a real target for where the EU should try to build expertise. Mario, you mentioned AI. I saw a headline recently that the EU has added a couple more unicorns, these venture capital firms that have reached €1 billion in funding, or $1 billion. I forget how they do it, with latest funding rounds in quantum computing in areas like that. So I guess my question is, how do we convince these very top talents to stay in Europe and find the financing that they need? Because historically, when it's come time to take those ideas to market, the US has had the best markets. And as we know, Europe has not yet formed a capital markets union. Daniel, what do you see as the interplay between the basic research and the getting that out into the world and the broader economy?
There is definitely a very strong link between top universities and then the number of, or the amounts of venture capital that their graduates attract, the number of unicorns, and the number of famous big firms that are founded by these graduates from these top universities. That is an ecosystem which is very difficult to replicate. I would say if I could choose between having, let's say, the equivalent of, let's say, even partially of MIT, Harvard, or Stanford in Europe, and having the Capital Markets Union, I would choose the former. I think the existence of these top talent, top ideas creating institutions, as Renhilde already pointed out, there are very few at the top, but they are the ones who are critical. If we had those, I think they would attract enough capital. Even if we don't have a good European capital markets, the venture capitalists from the US would come here and gobble them up and provide them with financing. So yes, I'm all for the European Capital Markets Union. It's overdue for a long time. But if I could choose, I would say I'd rather concentrate on creating really top research institutions in Europe. As I said, I cannot do that from today to tomorrow, but providing the ecosystem, the financing, national permissive laws, right, and regulations, that I think should be the first order of priority.
I hope we don't have to choose, and that is actually because we will be needing the two. Otherwise, we might be successful in creating some science hubs here, and for instance, ERC did make some progress on that. But from the analysis, we also know that actually who benefits most from this ERC top research, if you look at which patent cite ERC research, the US is overproportionately doing this here. So then it's them who will be benefiting from these scientific excellence that we are creating here. So in that respect, we should work on the two sides here. But again, I would like to point out that a lot of these innovation ecosystems linking science to innovation, basically they are global. And if you talk about top institutions, they see themselves as really international institutions here and not purely European ones. And the ones that are top because they are really international hubs here. That's the same for the US, but that's also the same for us here. So if we talk about creating these European clusters and hubs here, that should be really international posts here. And so keeping that international dimension, that's the only way forward.
Very much agreed. We should not think about creating European champions in that sense, but global champions that happen to be located in Europe.
Mario, based on your longtime study of the tech industry, do you think it's realistic for Europe to be an ideas generator and then have those ideas really grow in Europe rather than move to the US as soon as they're big enough to want, say, a less stringent regulatory environment or more money or other things like that? I mean, could we get in a situation where the true idea havers live in Europe because it's nice here and then they go to the US, or at least they send emissaries to the US when it's time to go big?
You left the tricky question really for the end. I mean, Rebecca, thank you. It's very hard to reply. I think I like to be an optimist too, and I see the narrative we have here in Europe when we talk about the digital economy is always very gloomy. We somehow look at ourselves always as seeing the aspects in which we lag compared to our international competitors. The primary culprit in this in the public discussion is always regulation. We look at regulation and we think that Europe is somehow entangling its own ideas. It's not able to produce them because, I mean, we have too many roots, essentially. And I disagree very much with that approach. I think it's definitely misleading, even though there are, of course, also some parts of truth in it, in the sense that we can be more efficient, not just with regulation, but in a number of dimensions, in order to make Europe prosper. But there are also very, very positive aspects of our approach that normally go below the radar. And I think the idea would be like to capitalize on those, right? I mean, here we have a model which is very different somehow. I mean, like, provided that we can talk about a model which is uniform across Europe, I mean, like, it's of course a stretch somehow. But I think, by and large, we can say that there are differences between, European preferences and the ones that have been expressed in the US or China. If we capitalize on those, we can create, flourishing ideas, successful ideas also in the digital economy. Just to make it more concrete, I mean, I think about our approach to privacy. Of course, I mean, like, the mainstream narrative is to say, because we are so much concerned about privacy, we are hampering our ability to innovate, progress in AI development, for example. But that's not really true. It's true only if you consider remove from your considerations the privacy dimension, so the qualitative dimension of AI. But from the moment in which, we take that into account and we want actually to have a technology which is actually more human friendly somehow, well, then Europe is quite successful, if you want, right? So I think we should actually put that on balance too. And I think, regulations that promote certain principles and the values that we believe in might also create the scope, the room for Europe to develop its own ideas that are somehow alternatives to the models that we see outside. So we shouldn't have like this, anxiety, this feeling of, being left behind and running after the other models. We can develop our own models and be actually proud of them.
I think it's really helpful, though, because certainly at this moment, anecdotally, we see a lot of top scientists, creative thinkers wanting to be in an environment where they can form their families the way they want and they can speak about what's on their mind. And these are things that under the Trump administration, people in university climates are under a lot of pressure not to do, or at least not to have full freedom to do the way that they used to. So thinking about personal freedom and then also freedom to innovate and freedom in a tech regulatory context, to me, it's a helpful continuum. As we bring this conversation to a close, what are some things you would like people to take away. Daniel, you said earlier that this $500 million won't be very helpful if it just expires at the end of the 3 years and there's no follow-up. What can we do to make the most of this money and really put it to use in whatever context?
First of all, we have to see what this money is, because the president of the commission cannot just change the budget on her own. This is not so easy. So my advice would be to her, think long term. If you have 500 million, okay, so be 500 million. But don't think about a three-year project. That won't work. Think about longer term and make sure that you get member states on board, because they are the ultimate arbiters of the budget. And I think you have to work on them to make sure that they understand this is an occasion not to be lost for Europe to increase its standing in international science and also foster its already, I think, emerging leadership in green technologies. That's what I would recommend.
I guess I would ask you, given everything we've been discussing and given sort of the tension in this moment, is there a way that the EU should deploy its resources or its funding? Should we go all in on climate and tech? Should we go broader and just trying to enhance human knowledge and hope that by going broad, all the good stuff will happen more here? Like, where do we go?
Actually, I mean, I don't feel I have the expertise to reply to that question, to be honest. What I would like to emphasize is that we should indeed have like this long-term perspective, as you know, Daniel just said. I mean, like Renilde, but this is so much we should repeat it like on and on, because you know what we need is something stable. We need to nurture an environment which will become attractive by itself in the future. You know, we need an ecosystem. We need investment in infrastructure, not just you know, funding one short term project and be able to catch the fugitive who is like had enough with the Trump administration, and in 5 years times will go back to the US. No, I mean, like, we really need to build something for the future of Europe, and this requires also some courage, some political courage, I guess. Because you know, maybe you won't see immediately the effect of that investment. By definition, if you invest, let's say, for example, more in infrastructure, maybe you don't see it immediately. But that's actually what we need. We need something which is stable, long lasting.
I would also like to be a bit more careful in terms of not seeing this too much of this is a kind of war that we are now playing, and in the sense that it's a zero-sum game here. Let's try to attract as much as possible from the US or from others here, or even within the EU, across member states, because that's the wrong perspective here that will very quickly end up into a negative sum here. I think we should really make sure that we do not, in order to get really the win-win out of this, do not break the science, technology, innovation machine here, which really thrives on the open international circulation of ideas here. If we turn this now into more war in terms of, okay, let's make sure that we as Europe, we can attract this. No, it has to keep this open atmosphere here, and we need to be open-minded in this here. And also, what I think is really important is also stress the European values of this, that we really are fully supportive of the freedom of being able to do research as well here. That's something that should really be very high and will help attract, making sure that we really will be becoming the international hub for science and technology if we continuously commit to that freedom to operate and choose your projects here. Very important.
Thank you very much. This has been a really interesting conversation. Thanks to all three of you for coming on in this moment. We have Reinhilde Voegelers from Bruegel, Daniel Gross from the Institute for European Policymaking, Mario Marinello from Bruegel. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. This has been The Sound of Economics. You can find all of our publications on this topic and others on our website, bruegel.org. Mario has a piece coming out very soon. And we look forward to seeing you again next time. Thanks for joining. We'll be right back.